The title of this address, Honest to God. You'll know the phrase, particularly if you were a former Catholic of a certain age. Honest to God, cross my heart and hope to die, often accompanied by the sign of the crucifix on the speaker's throat. It meant, of course, that God is witness to what has been said, so therefore the truth has been told. And of course, in the Bible, in Matthew and Luke, and elsewhere, Jesus points to the importance of honesty. We are known by our fruit and are warned that dishonesty will always be found out. And in James chapter 5, we are told not to swear, not by heaven or by earth or anything else. All we need to do is to say a simple yes or a simple no. And some of us may recall Honest to God, a book by Bishop Robinson in Britain, which stirred the religious pot, particularly among Anglicans. It discounted traditional views on Christian doctrine. For example, and quite Unitarian indeed, Jesus was said to be fully human, although he shows us God like no one else. And in a pitch for situation ethics, Robinson enjoined that people should live in the spirit with no absolutes but God's love, which will, he said, find its own particular way in every individual situation. More of this a little later. Nearly 30 years ago, some of us may remember, a group of brave and determined British women broke the law. Well, they broke the law according to the authorities, not in their view. They were, in fact, as they saw, upholding the law. But even as we might discuss whether they were or were not lawbreakers, a far more important issue arises. Were they behaving ethically and are morally? And the theme today here is that while we are, I'd suggest, a reasonably law-abiding congregation, is there a danger that we could allow ourselves to be hidebound by law with all the protections that that offers for our predominantly middle-class lifestyles, at the expense of behaving ethically? We'll use the word for convenience and interchangeably with morally. Or indeed, are we failing to appreciate those who behave as they see it ethically and contrary to are on the margins of what is legal, even if we would emphatically disagree with their behavior? We could think particularly of the Burke family and the row over the persistent attendance of Enoch at Wilson's Hospital School, contrary to court orders. But back to those brave women. 10 of them planned to disarm a British Aerospace Hawk fighter plane, which was to be sold to Indonesia, then brutally putting down opposition to its occupation in East Timor, now Timor-Leste. The women believed, that in destroying the fighter jet, they were preventing a crime taking place, that British Aerospace was aiding and abetting genocide. The prosecution said that they had damaged property belonging to someone else. What they did was irresponsible, and no law-abiding citizen would do such a thing. Anyway, as you may recall, a jury found them not guilty, much to the disgust of the Daily Telegraph and the right-wing tabloids. So So in essence, they were not lawbreakers. But even if the jury had found against them, would they have been behaving ethically? And in moral terms, would that supersede breaches of the law? The women, who took the name plowshares from the biblical phrase, "They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks," insisted that anybody can do a plowshare action. All you need is a hammer and a functioning arm. But of course, you need more. You need courage. As Osho wrote in The Joy of Living Dangerously, you need to have learned over time, as Derek Bell says, that directly confronting the scary things in life, as he said, "Let me both acknowledge my fear and move through it to an appropriate action." And quite topical, in Israel 22 years ago, 50 officers and soldiers in the Israeli army said they refused to serve in the West Bank and Gaza, and that the price of occupation was the loss of that army's semblance of humanity and the corruption of all Israeli society. They said they would no longer fight beyond the green line with the aim of dominating, expelling, starving, and humiliating an entire people. As Derek Bell puts it, these soldiers and officers manifested the courage of their convictions, placing conscience over military orders, a court-martial offence. A similarly supposedly law-breaking action, although probably no more than a gesture, came from an acquaintance, a Mennonite, who subtracted from his tax returns the equivalent percentage of what we spend on defence. This was a pointed action, but I think as we spend so little on defence, I think the revenue authorities probably ignored him. But the actions of this then young man, the soldiers, and the plowshare women indicate a willingness to see and act on a moral horizon beyond the law, as indeed does the behavior of Enoch Burke and of many of the protagonists who militantly oppose abortion provision. Derek Bell says he finds that people trying hard to lead ethical lives must draw on courage frequently because standing up requires taking risks on a regular basis. In fact, he says, risk-taking is probably the most defining act of an ethical life. It also shows, I believe, a rugged honesty, which is an essential ingredient of the ethical life, being indeed honest to God. Bell goes on to say that ethics requires us to think deeply about our positions on issues and take principled stands as a result of these positions. Principled stands, he says, will be tested regularly by society that valorizes external indications of success, such as money and corporate power, over much else. But let's go back a few hundred years to Thomas Hobbes and Immanuel Kant. For both, Susan Nyman tells us, the rule of law was vital. Civilization, she says, only begins when individuals concur in putting their competing wills into a framework that sets limits on all of them. But Hobbes and Kant soon part ways. Because for Hobbes, Any legal framework is better than none, which is why we may shiver when we hear references to a Hobbesian society. For Hobbesians, the rule of law comes first. The rule of the absolute sovereign is the basis for all other rules of any kind. And the allegiance owed to him, as it always was, is absolute. Kant, however, believed that the framework must be right and grounded in ideas of justice prior to any rules. Ethics was primary. So, if we go with Kant, that ethics is primary, that our ethical base and our indeed our personal morals should not be subservient to the law, whether it be secular or religious, where do we get our ethical base? We need courage, as Bell says, to behave ethically. So let's posit a scenario, hypothetical, I hasten to add. Cigarettes, as we know them, definitively caused deaths in Ireland in 2015 of nearly 6,000 people. And 1 in 2 smokers will die from a tobacco-related disease. If there is a large, isolated cigarette factory, and I'm assured there is no risk to life or limb, either in the factory or locally, am I ethically, morally entitled to use the equivalent of a hammer and a strong arm to destroy it? Am I being honest to God? Ethical, perhaps, although the law is being broken. Or indeed, is the law being broken if I am reducing the likelihood of people dying from tobacco use? So, where do we get our ethics? Let's just look very briefly at a few moral ethical dilemmas, not necessarily with answers, and some philosophies which may or may not deal with them. Euthanasia. David Robertson and Chris Garrett pose a few questions. Would you like to be treated by a doctor who you knew had killed some of his patients out of kindness? Or how would you feel if you knew that the doctors in a hospital would never agree to give you euthanasia, even though you were in intense, severe pain? If ever there was a subject which indicates that we can never achieve ethical certainty, as this book says, but that we can become more morally aware, I think this is it. Ralph Halvorsen, which we've often quoted in this church, talks about truth. Truth, he says, may have been established, but it is not therefore above criticism and debate and growth. So too, I'd suggest moral ethical truths. It is moral ethical truths are subject to continual growth, continual fulfillment. And then we may decide that we'd like to be moral relativists. Somebody who believes that objective truth does not exist, that all truths depend on opinion. Subjectivism, saying morality is relative to the opinion of a particular person, and conventionalism, that it is relative to the opinion of a group. Or we might prefer the stance of Richard Holloway, who has been quoted in this church before. For him, the morality of an act, and here he is talking about sexuality, relies on whether it harms people, our interests, violates their rights, or causes injustice. And he writes, just because the link between religion and ethics has been broken, I'm not too sure about that, it does not follow that we can't have ethics. So we must discover the importance, he says, of a non religious ethic. He says, and this came up in our second reading, that what many people have clearly departed from is any sense that the moral life lived intentionally and consciously is consistent with bland obedience to authority, including what is alleged to be divine authority. The difficulty, he says, is not with obeying what is genuinely known to be a divine command. It is the fact that history has taught us that so many claims on behalf of God have been subsequently rejected for moral reasons. To understand our ethical base too, we might listen to Oren Harman, and he writes about altruism, which he says is by any standard a defining characteristic of ethical behavior. He poses the question, where do we get our altruism feelings? Is it in fact something that is biological? And then goes on to write that there may be no human behavior, strictly speaking, that is without a genetic component, but, and quoting, that's a world away from saying that our genes determine who we are and what we choose. Or we may like to be a pragmatist. Julian Baggini talks about how the meaning of beliefs are to be understood not in abstract terms or ideas or the inner workings of the mind, but by the practical differences they make. And then, perhaps which will appeal to most of us, situation ethics. Peter Vardy and Paul Grosch write that adherents of situation ethics say there is no such thing as conscience, which should guide human action, at least if conscience stands for intuition or God in some way speaking to human beings. Conscience, he says, is simply the term used for attempts to make decisions appropriately according to the situation. And quoting again, situation ethics holds that nothing is good in itself except for love. Actions are good if they help human beings, and they are bad if they hurt people. There is no other criterion. Vardy and Grosch write that faced with the problem that the law may condemn something done from love, we can simply say that no actions are intrinsically wrong in themselves. Jesus and Paul replaced the Torah, the strict Jewish law, with the principle of love. Even the Ten Commandments are not absolute. For example, Bonhoeffer, in his book Ethics, considered the command against killing to be absolute, rejecting euthanasia. Yet he was accused of trying to kill Hitler and executed. So far we've heard a very varying number of ethical views, that we can never achieve ethical certainty, that objective moral ethical truth does not exist, that the morality of an act relies on whether it causes harm, that there may be something in our genes which determines our actions, even partly, that the practical difference an action makes is what is important and not abstract ideas, and that no action is good in and of itself except for love. And concluding, as we contemplate current and pending wars, it might be opportune to glance at what we could do ethically if attacked. John Yoder writes that it's often asked of pacifists whether they would sit back and allow a loved one to be attacked. But Yoder distinguishes between the individual threat and war. Even Gandhi and Thomas Merton were ready without embarrassment to acknowledge the legitimacy of the violent defense of one's immediate family or self without seeing that as any compromise in their rejection of all organized violence in social or national causes. If I killed a person menacing my family, escalation is relatively unlikely. But in a war, and recent events have shown this, escalation is practically unavoidable. Yoder says, there has never been a major war which does not take on greater dimensions of destructiveness as it continued than were projected by those who began it. War, indeed, might have to be the focus of our ethical thinking. And situation ethics might be the appropriate framework to address the issues, if, of course, we decide to circumvent the laws which we believe are unethical. If we believe, like Bishop Robinson, that love alone is able to embrace an ethic of radical responsiveness, meeting every situation on its own merits, and that, as Yoder writes, people should honestly evaluate a war which a given government is waging or wishes to wage, then occasionally, he says, they might reject the war, not on the grounds of general pacifism, but because it's not an acceptable political undertaking for someone who does not reject all killing. Such decisions are and will be faced by many people around the world. Hopefully not ourselves. The hope for peace, perhaps, is that their decisions are based on ethics and not on merely on any law requiring them to partake in a war. Amen and thank you.